Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. Amanda Armstrong will discuss trans politics, why the right is obsessed with the issue and other issues of gender and sexuality. And at the bottom of the hour, Alfredo Sadfilo returns to discuss the prospects for Brazil after the fascist Jair Bolsonaro won the presidential election. What are we to make of the Trump administration's attempts to reverse protections for trans people that were promulgated by Obama a couple of years ago? Many people have greeted this move as a distraction, an attempt to rile up an already enraged base even further in the run-up to the midterm elections. Is that right? I don't think so. I think issues around gender and sexuality are core to the right's worldview. And as we'll hear in the next segment, this was highly visible in the Brazilian presidential election as well. And, as we heard a couple of weeks ago, it was central to the right's appeal in the provincial elections in Quebec. For a closer look at these issues, here's Amanda Armstrong. She is a historian of labor, gender, and social protest who teaches at Fordham University. Amanda Armstrong. These Trump administration proposals, what will they do? What will the practical effects be on trans people?
It's hard to know kind of how far they'll go and what effect they will have. But essentially, potentially any federally mediated interactions will involve trans people sort of not having access to rights that they would have if trans existence were recognized legally. And so that can take the form of interactions with various state bureaucracies, welfare agencies, schools, health services.
Yeah, that anticipated my next question. So what the federal government does has a substantial influence on what happens at the state and local level.
That's right, yeah. And part of the concern would be situations where federal oversight or funding is involved. The other thing to say about it, though, is that, and this is a point that Dean Spade has made, the other effect of this kind of administrative reform would be in empowering kind of lower level bureaucrats in federal institutions, but not only, to interpret the law in ways that are unsympathetic to gender variant people.
Well, we've seen things that Trump says encouraging all kinds of terrible things. So this would just be another one of those, wouldn't it?
I think that's right, yeah. So it's important to understand the kind of formal legal effects, and those are somewhat up in the air, but then to also see this as part of an attack and and a kind of call to violence or a call to discrimination.
The rights that were promulgated at the federal level just came out of, what, executive orders from the Obama administration?
For the most part, and kind of administrative agency reforms.
So those are very easily reversible.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where they're kind of targeting, I guess you could say. And
do you have a sense of why trans issues have achieved the salience they have in recent years, both, you know, the struggle for acceptance, but also this reaction? Is it the increase in numbers, or what's responsible for this increased political and cultural salience of trans issues?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different ways to answer that, and I'm going to give kind of a partial response, and there are many factors that could be pointed to. You have a kind of long-standing trans movement that really took off in the context of the 70s. Of course, the Street Transvestites Action Revolutionaries, Sylvia Rivera and Marsha Johnson, are the best-known figures in that broader kind of post-Stonewall context. So you have a trans movement from the 70s. In the 90s, it was revitalized in various ways, and there were a number of trans anti-poverty campaigns in terms of people pushing for access to the Christopher Street piers or defending incarcerated trans people. And so, you know, this is a longstanding movement that I think made some strides and breakthroughs in ways that mirror the breakthroughs that the gay rights or gay and lesbian rights movements made in the 2000s. So I'd say that is probably the explanation for the salience of trans issues. But in terms of the configuration of the debate these days, what we're seeing is under the Obama administration, there were some moves that the administration, as well as some businesses, made to recognize trans people, right? And the nascent far right, this kind of white nationalist right, is trying to kind of configure the debate as one between them, who have the interests of the kind of working class majority at heart, on the one hand, against a left or a liberal force that is more concerned with marginal cultural issues. And so trans issues are sort of framed by the right as one of those kind of less consequential cultural issues.
Well, we also see people on the left, unfortunately, making the same argument.
Yes, and I think that's partly why the right is able to sort of kind of advance this line, and those on the left who make that kind of argument, I think, are only sort of strengthening that framing of that only serves the interests of the right. And so the task for the left would be, in this moment, would be, as I said, to link the interests of trans people with the broader interests that, of course, are shared in many ways of the working classes and oppressed communities. So to sort of have a politics that's able to advance social and economic transformation across a range of different domains at once.
Do you have any idea where this is coming from? This doesn't seem like a top concern of Trump's, but you never know. But are there, was it Pence, the Christians in the administration? What is pushing this development?
Yeah, you know, one thing about kind of anti-trans politics these days, I'd say more or less since 2016, is that they've been a kind of occasion for a finding of common cause between Breitbart conservatives, these sort of white nationalist formations, and the Christian conservatives. And the reason for that, I suppose, is that from the Christian conservative side, a kind of anti-trans politics follows from their defeat on gay marriage. So this is sort of their way to try to have the next campaign around a social issue that concerns them in terms of gender and sexuality. From the Breitbart side, it's partly about the kind of truculent masculinity masculinism that their politics entails. Also, especially in terms of the bathrooms, the way that it's about protecting implicitly white women in public space sort of links up with white nationalist vigilante politics in some way. So there's a kind of paternalistic logic, especially to the anti-trans bathroom bills. It's a point of convergence for these different factions that are in the White House, but sort of more broadly within the conservative movement.
Yeah, you started talking about this, and I'd like to develop this more. There are people who say, people on the left who say, that this is a distraction, it's just to energize the base, it's not something that is really at the core of their agenda. To me, these concerns about gender difference and hierarchy really are at the core of the conservative agenda. But could you lay out just how this relates to the worldview behind this?
Yeah, in terms of the conservative agenda, I think it's fair to say that this is at the core. I mean, it links up with kind of conceptions of normative family life and gender and sexuality that are also present in or manifested through their opposition to women's reproductive autonomy. And there's a kind of broader, as I said, masculinist investment that a kind of opposition to trans life reflects and kind of pushes forward. So yeah, I think that the conservative movement historically, or the right, I guess you could say, has historically had an investment in what they see as traditional forms of family life. And that's a kind of euphemism for the authority of the father and husband, right? So this kind of patriarchal logic. And the family, of course, is a key site of gendering, or place where gender norms and gender roles are kind of established and enforced. parents regularly disown trans people, and generally there are various restrictions on trans people forming families. Historically, this has been kind of more so than more recently, but even in parts of the world, including in Europe, trans people have to be sterilized in order to receive legal recognition. So there are various ways in which the family historically has been kind of hostile to trans existence. And I'd say that the defense of that kind of institution from feminist intervention is a core part of the project of the right.
I'm speaking with the historian Amanda Armstrong. Corey Robin, in his writings on as he talks about the right, makes a big point out of the fact that a lot of the emotional appeal of right-wing politics, to men in particular, but not only men, is the erosion of male authority in the household, in the family. So you know, this really is something that matters very intensely to day-to-day life to people on the right.
I think that's right. And what I would say is that there is a kind of popular dimension to transphobia, for lack of a better way of putting it, which I think it sort of links up with or relates to the anxiety that parents have about their children's potential gender variance. It's a kind of like widespread sentiment that you can see in terms of the experience that trans people have when they come out, in terms of their relation to their families. And so I think that's right, that this anti-trans politics of backlash is trying to tap into that, those sort of sentiments on the part of especially parents.
I remember when I had a very young child and dressed him in clothing that did not provide adequate gender cues for the masses. We would sometimes get yelled at, even on the, you know, the liberal Upper West Side of Manhattan, the archetypally liberal Upper West Side of Manhattan. This provokes anxiety. This kind of ambiguity provokes a lot of anxiety among even people who like to think of themselves as liberal and socially tolerant, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
And speaking of that, has there been any contribution to this anti-trans backlash coming from the proverbial TERFs, the trans exclusionary radical feminists? How important a factor is that in this backlash?
Right. Yeah. I think in the U.S. less than in other places, especially Britain. So to go back again to the anti-trans bathroom bills of 2016, there were at the time some kind of marginal groups claiming a feminist commitment that were formally aligned with the Christian right and that were involved in various lawsuits to try to prevent trans people from having access to public facilities. And to some extent, those lawsuits, for instance, give a little bit of cover to the argument that you see in these anti-trans mobilizations, especially starting in 2016, the argument that is that these reforms or these regressive policies are potentially going to defend the safety of women, right? So if you have some people identified as feminists kind of making that argument, it becomes more plausible, perhaps. But I think in terms of the driving force behind these moves, it's much more this kind of coming together of the kind of white nationalist Breitbart wing and the historic evangelicals, which of course are very much imbricated in or tied up with, they're involved in a kind of reaction to the civil rights movement. So we should be clear about that as well.
Now, there's some really stunning numbers on the levels of poverty and of violence or victims of violence among trans people. To people who be listening who might think this is not a terribly material concern, could you review some of those statistics?
Yeah, I don't know if I will be able to cite numbers, but certainly, and this is something that Fine and Laca has emphasized in their piece in Jacobin and the Socialist Worker, that the oppression of trans people is a social oppression. That is, we experience the denial of access to housing, rates of street violence and intimate partner violence at very high levels, job discrimination, imprisonment, poverty, these various metrics of social oppression at remarkably high levels. So certainly, insofar as the project of the left is about the realization of social equality. The social oppression of trans people should be of central concern. And I think the question then becomes sort of on what basis are coalitions or broader political demands and projects found and articulated that will advance the interests of trans people in a broader context of advancing sort of social and economic transformation in the interests of the working classes and other oppressed communities.
You've done academic work in the relation between trans issues and the labor movement. Give us the summary of what that's all about.
My most direct work along these lines is kind of organizing work. So when I was a graduate student at the University of California, I was involved in UAW 2865, the union representing graduate TAs. And in our 2013-14 contract campaign, one of the demands that we were pushing was for a right to access to all gender bathrooms within a reasonable distance of the workspace. So this is a kind of demand that is meant to address the forms of transphobic violence and harassment that trans people face at work. And the goal was to sort of articulate this reform or this demand as part of a larger contract campaign where we were pushing around, obviously, wages and health benefits, issues affecting student parents and undocumented student workers. And we were able to win on the broad range of those issues. So I think that was an example of an effort to kind of move within the context of labor organizing to advance the interests of trans people as part of a broader project of social transformation or kind of advancing the interests of working class and oppressed groups.
And now, people who are not trans, what can we do in solidarity to help? Because this is, you know, there's so much appalling stuff going down right now that it's hard to know what to do or where to start or what to think. But help us out. What can we do?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I know that there are protests popping up. There's one in New York this evening. This is Monday the 29th. But so certainly showing support and solidarity against this regressive anti-trans initiative in the streets is key. And then insofar as people are involved in unions or tenants' organizations or these sort of organs of working class struggle, the goal would be to find ways to advance the interests of trans and more broadly gender nonconforming people who are sort of part of that institution, who live in that building or work in that workplace or who could live in that building or work in that workplace, to sort of find ways to advance the interests of trans people in that context so that we're kind of building a sense of solidarity and a sense of a shared fate in these very tangible ways between trans and non-trans people and communities.
That was Amanda Armstrong, an assistant professor of history at Fordham. I apologize for putting her on the spot, asking her to cite statistics on poverty and violence. Not everyone shares my number fetish. Here are some from a 2015 survey of almost 28,000 trans people, sponsored by the National Center for Transgender Equality. Nearly a third of trans people are in poverty, more than twice the national average. The same share has been homeless for some time in their life, and 12% have been homeless in the previous year. Poverty, as you might expect, is considerably worse among trans people of color, with poverty rates over 40%. 1 in 6 reported losing a job because of their gender identity. The unemployment rate among trans people was 3 times the national average at the time. Almost 40% had experienced severe psychological distress in the year before the survey, 8 times the national average. The same share have attempted suicide at some time in their lives, more than 8 times as much as the broad population. 1 in 10 was the target of violent attack by a family member. Nearly half reported harassment in the previous year, and 1 in 10 had been physically attacked. Almost half had been sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. Still, not all the survey's findings were awful. More than half, 60%, reported their families being supportive, although almost 1 in 10 had gotten kicked out of the house. More than 2/3 reported their coworkers as supportive. Trump's actions, however, will be the enemy of such progress. For more, Google USTS 2015. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Was the second of eight piano pieces, Opus 8, by the German composer Hans Eisler, performed by Matt Rubinstein. Eisler was a communist driven out of Germany by the Nazis. He came to the U.S. in 1938, where he was granted asylum, but he was hounded out of this country during the McCarthy years and was deported in 1948. In Berlin on November 11th, Rubinstein is performing a selection of piano music, as he puts it, by composers from five different countries run by fascist governments, all written during the Second World War. Eisler is among them. Next, Brazil. Alfredo Sadfilo was on this show a few weeks ago to discuss the imminent election of a far-right character named Jair Bolsonaro as president. Bolsonaro won that election a few days ago, adding to the heavy dose of grim news in this world. From 2003 to 2016, Brazil was governed by the Workers' Party, a social democratic party that was long led by Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, universally known as Lula. He served as president from 2003 to 2011, when he was succeeded by Dilma Rousseff. She was, it's no exaggeration to say, overthrown by a soft coup led by right-wing forces in the National Congress in August 2016. Lula was imprisoned on trumped-up corruption charges in April of this year. Rousseff was succeeded by her vice president, Michel Temer, a colorless right-winger with a disapproval rating of 82%. Replacing him will be Bolsonaro come January. Here's Alfredo Sadfilo, a professor of political economy at the School for Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, to explain. Well, we can't say this was a surprise. It had been anticipated for quite a few weeks now, but still, how's it feel? I'm a little embarrassed to begin with such a subjective question, but it's quite a shocker, isn't it?
It is a big shock. It is a big shock in several ways, including because it was predicted recently, but the rise of Bolsonaro is a phenomenon of the past 3 months or so. Before then, there was a wide variety of candidates across the whole spectrum, from center-left to the right. And there was an attempt that reminds one of what happened in the Republican Party in the United States when Donald Trump was bidding for the presidency. A gradual elimination of one potential contender after another. Now, in this case, they were all candidates in the election from different parties and different coalitions, but they did not manage to find mass attraction, and one candidate after another would not rise in the opinion polls. And the media and the mainstream right, the center right, were betting on one after the other in sequence, and none of them would find mass traction. And eventually, they all settled for Bolsonaro. The media, the industrial federations, the big capitalists of Brazil, all of them, and the upper middle classes, and a large parcel of the evangelical churches and informal workers, they converged around Bolsonaro in the final weeks of the campaign, and by exclusion, because nobody else had shown the possibility of beating the Workers' Party, the PT, in the elections themselves. So Bolsonaro was very, very much a last resort, and it was a terrible choice because he is inexperienced, unable to hold together a large coalition of interests, and incapable, as far as we can tell at this point, of maneuvering the Brazilian political system that is very complex and very decentralized. So the prospects for Bolsonaro administration are of great turbulence and turmoil and profound instability at the same time.
Brazilian friends and relatives tell me they've been surprised to learn that members of their own family, who otherwise seem decent and even liberal in temperament, had voted for Bolsonaro. Do you think that's a widespread phenomenon?
I think it is widespread, yes. If you look first at the distribution of votes, Bolsonaro won in most urban areas in the country and across the segment of higher incomes and more years of education. Bolsonaro won with a great majority in those segments. In a large number of urban areas, Bolsonaro captured 70% of the votes. And the PT candidate won primarily in small towns and in rural areas and amongst the poorest and most disorganized strata of the population. So for someone who is in the middle class, lives in an urban area, you're very, very likely to have a lot of people that you know and family members who will have voted for Bolsonaro. And the media and social media have reported extensively family divisions, profound family divisions, family fights between people who would vote for different candidates. It was a very, very polarized election in a way that Brazil has not seen, I think, ever before. There have been polarized elections in Brazil before, but not to this extent.
Now, when people talk about the Trump base, it can be a confusing thing because, you know, there are at least three kinds of people who voted for Trump, like traditional Republicans who just want tax cuts, disaffected people who just wanted to give the middle finger to the system, and, you know, outright reactionaries and lunatics and fascists. Is there something similar in the Bolsonaro vote?
There is something similar, but I think the base is slightly distinct. I think Bolsonaro brought together different segments of the population. I have already mentioned that his support was involved a cross-section of society. He supported capital, supported the upper middle class, support of some former workers, but I suspect not that many, but significant support amongst the disorganized informal workers. And he managed to do this partly by chance. He was the candidate with the best had the best set of circumstances to bring all these sources of support together. Because he pretended to be the outsider, even though Bolsonaro has been a federal deputy for 28 years, because he was so lonely and so marginalized and nobody took him very seriously, he could pretend to be the outsider who is coming with a clean slate. He doesn't owe anything to anybody, and he can be the candidate who will put things right in Brazil. This is, to some extent, similar to Trump, except Bolsonaro was a politician before. Then Bolsonaro captured the moment in the sense that the Brazilian political system is profoundly damaged by allegations of corruption and by the anti-corruption campaign that has been unleashed by the judiciary and the media about 5 years ago with a deliberate intent of targeting the PT, the Workers' Party, using lawfare and accusations of corruption to persecute first Dilma Rousseff, who was president and was then impeached in 2016, and subsequently former President Lula, who was imprisoned and is currently in jail for 12 years. So Bolsonaro, being the outsider, captured this moment saying, I am the only candidate who is not corrupt. I'm the only candidate who is not involved in schemes of corruption in Brazil. Then he captured the conservative vote. But it's a conservative vote, not necessarily just a political vote, but it's a vote that is connected to the evangelical churches. There's a large number of evangelical churches in Brazil. Those churches have captured an enormous number of faithful in the country. Brazil, 30 years ago, was a Catholic nation, a vast majority. Today, it is no longer that. And many of those evangelical churches are very fragmented. Many of them are very, very right-wing, and they converge around issues of public morality. They converge around the fact that they are all uniformly, strongly against any form of abortion. And Brazil has very rigid laws about that, but they want to make sure that those laws continue to be in place. Issues of public morality around homosexuality very, very strongly came up, very, very strongly in the campaign. And issues of the sanctity of the family, the marriage, your family as a unity of a man and a woman, etc. So they came down very, very strongly there, and that resonated with a large mass of people. And then urban violence, another major issue that Bolsonaro could thrive on. Brazil is a very violent society. Last year, there were 60,000 murders in Brazil, of which 5,000 were perpetrated by the police forces. Now, Brazil is a very violent country, and the fear of violence is very, very prevalent across society. It affects mainly the poor, while the rich, they watch violence on television. There are TV programs that are dedicated to violence, and they beam on your living room every day, the crimes of the day, and the more grisly the murder, the better for the audience. So that creates an atmosphere where people across society, except for the very rich, who can always protect themselves, but across society, people feel afraid and define themselves by being afraid. And Bolsonaro, being a former military officer, promised, made easy promises about guns and about protecting people by using the state violence. And he did this with great success. He seemed to be, again, the outsider, the person who is not corrupt, who talks sense in simple language, and who presents common sense solutions to difficult social problems. So there is a lot of violence, just kill the criminals. That's what you do, right? So there is a problem with drugs, kill the drug traffickers. That's, again, the simple solution that Bolsonaro was offering. And that has mass appeal because complex solutions are difficult to explain and they're very difficult to argue for, and they can always hedge, and the policy is complex, etc. Bolsonaro cuts through all the complexity, but the problem, evidently, is that the real world is complex. So Bolsonaro's promises will clash against the complexity of reality, but this will be only later. He has already been elected on the basis of simplicity. Let's see how he deals with the real world.
I'm speaking with the political economist Alfredo Saad Filho. Some of the commentary coming from the left has emphasized the culpability of the Workers' Party in producing this outcome. That is, they were deeply corrupt and too complicit with neoliberalism, that they were the reformism was too soft, they didn't really push a more radical agenda, and couldn't win over a large part of the populace for this reason, and left a lot of resentment behind. How culpable is the PT in this story?
The PT could and should have done more for their core constituency of the organized working class. They could and should have compromised less with neoliberalism. They could and should have imposed a reform of the media. They should have transformed the legislation around the financing of political parties. They should have relied more on small donations by their membership and the militants of the party, and less on big donations by large companies that evidently would only come in exchange for favors. The Brazilian political system, the way it is built, it is intrinsically corrupt. Now, corruption has been the way in which the Brazilian state has functioned for 500 years. And it continues to be the case. Now, the political system that exists now, that was built after the transition to democracy 30 years ago, there's ample freedom to create political parties, and there are many political parties around. In this Congress that has been elected this month, there are 30 political parties represented, none with more than 15% of the lower chamber. So it is a fragmented system with a president that is elected in two rounds, like the French system. So the president gets to power with tremendous legitimacy in the eyes of public opinion and with the compulsion to deliver on his or her program, but they do not have, by construction, a majority in Congress. So the way to build that majority and to be able to move legislation through Congress is to exchange favors. So the system is corrupt at the point of financing the political parties, and it is corrupt at the point of passing the laws. And at a further level, if you want to build those coalitions, you, the president, you need to bring in allies and distribute the ministries between different political parties. And the ministries are interesting for the parties only in the sense, and for the individuals, only in the sense that they command resources and that they can allocate those resources more or less at will and then favor their own agendas, favor their own people. If you're not going to do this, you cannot govern. And this was one of the challenges that former President Dilma Rousseff had. She was a scrupulously honest president who tried to govern according to the laws of decency and according to a particular political program. And that does not work. She was initially despised by members of Congress and then hated by them because she was not open for business. Now, Bolsonaro comes in and he claims that he will not be corrupt and that his government will be clean and that he will give initially the majority of ministries to the military, and now he's backtracking on that one. He needs that currency in order to build coalitions that will support his program in Congress. Now, Bolsonaro will have an easier ride than Dilma Rousseff did, because the Congress that has been elected now is the most right-wing Congress in modern Brazilian history. Two-thirds of the members of Congress are on the far right. It's not just the right, it's on the far right. So their worldview will tend to converge with Bolsonaro's worldview, and so he can expect some support there. Bolsonaro can also count on the at least implicit support of the judiciary that has been very, very closely aligned with the right. But that is at the level of big programs and ideologies. On the day-to-day of individual pieces of legislation navigating through committees in Congress, that requires a level of understanding of the rules of politics that Bolsonaro does not have. And he does not have the experience or the talent to negotiate with a very powerful but also deeply fractured Congress. So again, I expect political instability in Brazil after an initial period of honeymoon when Bolsonaro is going to try and steamroll as much as he can of his own program to try and make irreversible reforms. But we will see in a matter of months instability building up in the system with, again, unpredictable consequences for Bolsonaro himself and for the Brazilian political system.
One of the more appalling aspects of Trump has been the way he's been able to whip up the worst elements in American society to levels of frightening rage and violence. Do you see Bolsonaro doing the same? He's already got that process going, right?
He has got that process going. The presidential campaign was the most violent campaign in modern Brazilian history. There were several killings. There were beatings on the streets, and there was a level of violence and intimidation that is abnormal by Brazilian standards, and that is in a violent society. Subsequently to the election, there have been reports, a large number of reports in the media of intimidation, of shootings, of behavior that is meant to be aggressive towards the left, and of a large number of threats being issued. Bolsonaro has done nothing to contain that. Now, will this degenerate into growing levels of violence, some of it random, some of it targeted? This is possible. Will the police and the judicial system be in a position to contain that? Well, in principle, they are in a position to contain it, but so far, they have demonstrated no inclination to do so. So it is perfectly plausible, and sections of the Brazilian left are expecting an escalation of repression and intimidation and violence against social movements, political parties of the left, and ultimately anyone walking on the streets with a T-shirt. That's been random acts of violence against people wearing red on the street. Or alternatively, Bolsonaro might want to play the role of great state and try to bring people, his people under control and then try to heal the country. My impression is that he's not able to do this, and he's not willing to do this either. He thrives on the politics of hatred, and my impression is that he will try to govern in this way. A little bit looking at Donald Trump, but in an even more grotesque way, in an even more crass manner, in a society that is more violent than even than U.S. Society. So again, the prospect for the left, for social movements, and prospects for dissent are not good. The tendency will be of growing levels of violence on the streets.
I'm speaking with the political economist Alfredo Sodfilo. People throw around the word fascism a lot now, if anybody deserves that label, it seems like Bolsonaro certainly does. But you know, the contrast with the fascist movements of the 30s, they're not the organized militias, they're not the parties, there's not the detailed ideology to go along with it. How valid is that analogy? How seriously should we take it?
This is not classic fascism, because as you said, the rise of leaders like Bolsonaro, but then there's a large number of other leaders around the world at this point in time, they are not rising on the back of an organized mass movement, much less on the back of organized militias that are confronting against a large movement from the other side, specifically communism. There is no such opposition today. The authoritarian leaders that have risen in our recent period since the global crisis started in 2008, these authoritarian leaders, and including Bolsonaro, they have risen mostly through the manipulation of the media. They've risen through the use of economic resources and economic clout to buy elections. They have risen by tricking the voters, presenting to them a nationalist program, a dissenting program, to promising to do something different from the what existed before, that they do not identify, but is very clearly that they are selling the idea that they will confront neoliberalism and they will do a different kind of politics that cares about the little guy, the little girl, cares about them, looks at their interests, looks at their job prospects, is sensitized to the fact that globalization, financialization have led to massive losses for large strata of the population, and the leader, this person who is detached from the day-to-day of common politics and comes from the outside, this leader will, by force of will, change the realities for people in terms of their jobs and their life prospects. And people, understandably, under stress, under economic and political and social stress, and that solution seems appealing to them. That's very different from the problems of fascism and the solutions that fascism provided back in the 1930s. But these leaders cannot do that. They can't do that today because they are committed to neoliberalism. So you vote against neoliberalism and you get an intensified version of neoliberalism plus violence, plus state arbitrariness, plus the steamrolling of all forms of opposition. In my understanding, this is a very unstable situation that will slide. It is not possible to maintain this type of leader in power, promising to do one thing, selling a particular image on the back of money and economic resources, and then delivering exactly the opposite. So I don't think this political configuration that we see today can remain in place for very long.
Over the last month or so, Brazilian stocks are up about 20%. Mexican stocks are down about 20% as they anticipate AMLO's inauguration. But do you think that these big capital in Brazil, which is anticipating something of a windfall from this new government, are they going to get what they're anticipating?
That is plausible. The Temer administration that has been in power since 2016, after Dilma Rousseff was overthrown, has managed to roll back labor protections, and impose a cap on the fiscal budget to stop the possibility of state intervention in the economy and stop the possibility of industrial policy. Bolsonaro has one big thing that he wants to achieve and is possible to achieve rapidly, which is the reform of the social security system. Now, this Temer tried for 2 years and could not get it past Congress because it's very, very polemical and creates massive losses for the workers and for pensioners. Bolsonaro has promised to push this forward, and capital is counting on that. So it's a massive windfall for capital, reduction of costs, and the cost of the entire social security system would decline significantly in that case. Capital is also betting that Bolsonaro will relax the gun control legislation. It's betting that Bolsonaro will privatize large chunks of the state assets. So they're expecting to make a killing buying assets, state assets, very, very cheaply. So there is anticipation that in some areas of the economy there will be significant profits to be made, and in general a much more conducive environment for business. The economic policies that Bolsonaro has been pointing towards through his Minister of Finance, the coming Minister of Finance, Paulo Guedes, are the same policies as those that were implemented in Chile under General Pinochet. Paulo Guedes is a Chicago boy. Paulo Guedes was involved with the Chilean administration under Pinochet. So capital can see those signs of a much more favorable context for economic policy in Brazil in the period to come. Will it be possible to deliver? I think it's very unlikely. There is no engine for the Brazilian economy at this point in time. The main engine traditionally has been the external engine. But the global economy is likely to grow less rapidly in the coming period. China is growing more and more slowly. Brazil has no significant markets to open abroad. The economy depends heavily on the export of primary commodities. Domestic investment has contracted. Public sector spending is limited by the Temer administration and its fiscal policy reforms. Households are highly indebted and trying to pay off their debts, and the level of unemployment is very high. So there may be a bubble connected to privatization or foreign investment coming into the country, but I expect this bubble to be relatively short-lived. I don't see any prospect of sustained rapid growth in Brazil at this point in time.
And finally, the left. Is there anything like an organization or a strategy or an agenda to fight Bolsonaro, or is that a vacuum?
The left has been developing an agenda to fight Bolsonaro. In general, the Brazilian left campaigned very bravely and very strongly. It is of interest that they achieved 45% of the vote on the back of the left wing alone. It was not possible, it turned out, to bring onto the camp of the left in support of the candidate, Fernando Haddad, anybody of any significance from the center. Now, that may be because the image of the PT has been badly corroded by its years in power, because the PT tends to adopt an attitude of monopolizing the field and demanding that unquestioning support from other political forces, and it's not, the PT is not very good at making coalitions in its campaigns. But the fact is that the left was isolated, and it still managed to achieve 45% of the votes, which is fantastic. But it doesn't have a clear program, and the candidate, Fernando Haddad, did not have a very clear program in this election. He was selling an image of the return to the past under Lula. It's not clear how we get there. He was selling an image of being the candidate of civility and constitutional democracy and political freedom and respect, in contrast with Bolsonaro's absolutely right-wing and unacceptable statements in his whole campaign. But what the left was doing is not a political program, and it's not clear how the left is going to develop a political program that is appealing to large numbers of people, that keeps the country together, that makes the left electable, and that allows it to govern in a transformative way, much more than what was possible under Lula and under Dilma Rousseff. We're not at that point yet.
That was Alfredo Saad Filho, a professor of political economy at the School for Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Class War, the 1977 song from the Dills, in a new cover version by Ty Siegel. The music is rather folkier than usual for me, but I like the sentiments. Till next week, bye.